Good evening. My name is Dale, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is the 4th of July, 2006. I have a home group in Richmond. It's called the Awakenings Group. It meets on Sunday mornings at 9:30 at the Temple Masonic Lodge on Forest Hill Road. We are a speaker meeting. You may have, if you've been to any meetings in Richmond, we used to be at Johnston Willis Hospital, and we moved this year to the Masonic Lodge. So come see us if you're ever in Richmond at 9:30 in the morning. We have a great speaker meeting there. I have a sponsor. I spoke to her today. We met on Thursday and had a nice meeting and cleared out some things that I needed to talk to her about. So I'm current with her. I don't just have her in name only. She knows who I am when I call. I always say that staying in contact with my sponsor helps me play well with others. And I don't think it's been, I don't think it's a secret that those of us that stay around here for a while and stay in the middle stay sponsored. I grew up in a small town in western Kentucky. And I got to Virginia. I went to school here about 20 years ago. But I like to tell this story. Every summer, a friend of mine, Bob, who does a lot of archives work over in the Tidewater area, which is where I was sober for 5 years and I moved to Richmond in 2012, we always talk about taking a trip to New York to the AA archives. And we've never made it yet. But we talk about it every summer. And something comes up. And whenever we talk about it, I always think about one of the last times I went to New York. This is back when I was still drinking. And this is a situation that happened to me. And for some reason in the last couple of years, it just crystallizes to how I looked at my alcoholism before I knew it was alcoholism and that that's what my problem was. People would ask me, what's your problem? And I didn't know. I'd say, what's your problem? But, I just was like, I knew that I couldn't manage my own life. I knew that everything kind of ended up in the ditch, whether that was what I intended or not. But I didn't know what my problem was. So one summer, I had a friend that lived in Baskin Ridge, New Jersey. And the plan was I come up to New Jersey, I leave my car there, I stay at her house a couple of days, I can take the train into New York City for about 45, it's like a 45-minute ride, and take the train back, and I don't have to worry about parking or pay for hotels or anything like that. And then I was going to be there about a week, and then the last couple of days I would get a hotel and stay in Manhattan, and this was my way to manage this trip to New York City. So I did that a couple of days, and it was working out just fine. And one Thursday, I went into the city. I went to see a Broadway show. I goofed around in the city all day, ate food, pretzels, and stuff from the street vendors. And I go back to the train station. This is Penn Station, New York City. It's right after the theaters let out. I don't know if you've been there, but it's just crazy. There's people everywhere, and it's just... It's 11 o'clock at night, but it could be 8 o'clock in the morning. It's just crazy. And I buy my ticket and I go wait for my train. And I'm just kind of sitting around waiting for my train. And I thought I heard something that I should listen to, but I wasn't sure. But it was kind of like wah 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 wah, Baskin Ridge, New Jersey. And I thought, well, that's where I'm going. Maybe I should pay attention. So I tried to focus, and I heard. I thought, are they calling my train? It's not time for my train. And I heard, would the woman who just bought a one-way ticket to Baskin Ridge, New Jersey, please report to the MTA security desk? And I say, oh, they want to talk to someone who bought a ticket to Baskin Ridge, New Jersey. And I just sat there, just reading my program and just looking at my magazines. And I heard, again, would the woman who just bought a one-way ticket to Baskin Ridge, New Jersey, please report to the MTA security desk? And I thought, well, they really want to talk to her. She should go see them. And I was thinking, gosh, last night I was on the train all by myself at night going out to Baskin Ridge, New Jersey. Tonight I will have company, and it will be a woman. Because there is somebody who bought, I'm not kidding you, there's somebody. So after about the third or fourth time that I heard this, I thought, could he be paging me? No. Why would anybody in Penn Station in Manhattan be paging me? That's just crazy. So his voice kind of started to sound irritated. I'm not going to try to do New York accents. Like, would the woman please report to the MTA security desk? And just as it's like almost time for my train, I think, just on the off chance that I might be the person that they're referring to, I will go to this MTA security desk. And so I just begrudgingly walked up to the desk and I said, you probably don't mean me, but I did buy a one-way ticket to Basking Ridge, New Jersey. He's like, yeah, like half an hour ago, I've been paging you and paging you and paging you. And he starts to yell at me. And I was like, what is it? What do you want? And he handed me my ticket. And what it was is like when you buy a ticket, kind of like at the movie theater, there's that part on the back of it that's not really your ticket. It's like apparently it had spit both parts out. I had grabbed the first part and walked away. And a nice man saw me walk away, couldn't get my attention, took my ticket to the security desk. And he said, you never would have been able to go on the train. And God, and I was literally like right over there, and there's the desk. And yes, he was paging me in Penn Station in Manhattan, and I almost missed the train. And I tell that story because that's what it was like to be an active alcoholic pretty much all through my 20s and 30s and have people say, you might have a problem with drinking. And I go, no, it can't be me. It can't be me. I just couldn't see it. I just couldn't see it. And then, you know, I would hear the talk out there, like the announcer on the intercom, and I just couldn't think that that had anything to do with me. And I would have something very specific, like, you drank so much, you embarrassed me, or we don't want you to work here anymore, or are you ever going to have a car that you don't wreck? All this evidence was accumulating, and I'm still going, I just don't think that's the problem, and really wasn't. That was the solution, but I just couldn't see it. I took my first, I don't remember my first drink. It was probably a sip of some kind of cheesy wine, like Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill or something like that from my parents. But I do remember my first drunk, and it was at the Sonic New Year's Eve party. I don't know if you have Sonic around here. It's a fast food restaurant where I was car hop. And I was 15, and I was working with all these older people who were 19 and 20, and they were having a big New Year's Eve party. Sometimes I look back on like why my dad let me go, but he dropped me off there and they showed me a punch bowl with people were pouring in bottles of white liquors in it, and they said it was going to be great, and I said sure, and I took some of it, and that's pretty much it. I don't remember the rest of the night. I vaguely remember going, gosh, I can barely taste the alcohol. And And I woke up the next morning. I was at home. I lived about a quarter mile from the people who were having the party. And it was New Year's Day. I'm at home by myself, laying on the sofa. I still have my coat on, my mittens, and my little toboggan hat. And I've got my hands kind of across my chest, and I just sort of look around. I don't remember being really hungover. What I think is significant about that now is that's my first drunk, and I've blacked out the whole night, hours worth of time. And it took me a while to realize that that's not what happens to people who aren't like us. A lot of people can have a drunk or a drink in their teen years and not black out. That didn't send me off to the races just yet. I was a really good student in high school, and I was really eager to please people. And so I wanted to go away to college. No one in my family had gone away to college. I was torn between two career paths. I wanted to be either a country music singer or a neuroscientist. My dad had bought me this book when I was about 8 or 9 years old because I had gotten fascinated with some story on the news where this woman had pulled a car off her child. Y'all ever heard about that, where the adrenaline and the dopamine and just the right neurochemicals will pile up enough in your body that you can do these sort of superhuman things? And apparently as a little kid, I just went around talking about it and wondering how that happened and what causes that. And so those kinds of little neuroscientific things would come up, and my dad would try to encourage me in those ways. So, but I resolved all that and went to law school instead. So so that was how I ended up in Virginia. After I went to college in Kentucky, I came here to Virginia for law school, to Washington Lee. And that is when my drinking took off. There were some moments. There were more blackouts. There was more, there were embarrassed, a couple of embarrassing moments. But my drinking just didn't really cross over until my early 20s. And I don't know what it was about Virginia, but I think a lot of it was this anxiety of being in this school where there's a lot of smart people, and I'm from this small town in Kentucky, and I come from a family of railroaders and coal miners, and I don't know exactly what it was, but I knew that at that, it was in those years in Lexington that I just seemed to not be able to get enough to drink. And I could still hold it together. I always call it like holding that beach ball underwater. I just kind of hold it together for a while. And then after the exams were over or some big, you know, pressure situation was over, I could binge really well from like Thursday till 4 o'clock on Monday morning or something. And that's when people first started saying to me, you know, I don't like you so much when you drink. You're not, you know, you're not always that much fun. Sometimes you're funny, but not always. You know, I gave you, my roommate said, you know, I gave you $20 to go to the bar and get us a drink, and I never saw you the rest of the night or something like that. You know, things like that would start to happen where I'm not fun to be around. I would wake up, Lexington's not a huge town, but I'd wake up and not know where my car was. And people would have to help me find it. And that went on for like another 15 years. So I don't know if I was alcoholic. I was certainly drinking alcoholically at times. I was a huge binge drinker. That was very unpredictable, I think, for people because people didn't call me an alcoholic, but I think they thought if you can keep it together for a month or a couple of weeks or through exams, then you're just cutting loose a little too much and you should just cut back on those times that you're drinking or whatever. So I moved up to Northern Virginia for my first job. I wanted to go to trial. I wanted to go to the courtroom, and I did. I worked in the public defender's office in Fairfax County for 5 years, and it was what I wanted to do. I remember seeing public defenders on TV. I saw one on this show, Hill Street Blues, and she lived in Manhattan, and she drove a Mercedes, and I just thought she was fabulous. Veronica Hamill played her. If you're under like 40, you don't know who that is. But I just thought, you know, I'm like, wow, I'm in Northern Virginia and I've got a Toyota and it's great. You know, it's close enough, you know, it's close enough. And I'm going to court all the time and I'm real smart alecky when I'm cross-examining police officers. And I apologize if there's any in here. And I was having a blast. And in my mind, everybody in my office drank like me. That's probably not true, but that's what I thought. We were always out at happy hour on Thursdays and always out at happy hour on Friday, and several of us were good friends outside the office, and we were out drinking in the D.C. area on Saturday and probably Sunday too. It was a smaller group of us probably that would go have 3 or 4 beers on a Monday or a Tuesday, but there still was a group of us. So I didn't really think that there's a problem here, but I look back on it now, and I think a lot of those people were heavy drinkers, but maybe not necessarily alcoholic, because they did things like meet women, you know, meet someone that would become their wife, or they would have a child, or they would, you know, get promoted, and then they didn't do that kind of crap anymore. But I kept doing that, and I started to have problems with depression, and I decided I need to find the right psychiatrist and the right medication. And I think I went through 3 or 4 different psychiatrists. The last two sat me down, looked me in the eye, and this is like the guy in the train station, and said, I think you should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first time that happened, I said, I thought you just said Alcoholics Anonymous. I must be like hearing things. I swear I said that. And she said, yeah, I did. I think you should go. And I was sitting in her office at like 11 o'clock on a Friday. I had called in sick from work and said, I'll try to be in after lunch, but I'm going to run by the doctor's office. I'm hungover. I'm depressed. I'm lying to her about how much I'm drinking. I tell her I'm having a couple of drinks. We had a joke in the PD's, public defender's office. Do not have a couple of drinks and mind your own business, because that's exactly what all our clients would say to us. I would say, I would go in to see someone. I would say, oh, you know, the warrant says someone was stabbed. And he'd say, I don't know. I had a couple of drinks, but I was just minding my own business. So, and we would hear that over and over again. And I had a really good friend who was an ER doctor, and he would say the same thing. He's like, same thing. People come to the ER and just tell me they'd had a couple of drinks and got stabbed somehow. And so I would tell her that I had a couple of drinks, but that this particular day I was hungover because Thursday I hadn't gotten some bad news in court, and so that's why. But finally, you know, she said, I think you should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just went, what? Alcoholics Anonymous? Are you serious? And I was flabbergasted. You know, here I am, somebody who drinks 5, 6, 7 days a week at this point. And I think she's just crazy. I can't see it. I was probably about 30 at the time. And we had talked a couple months earlier about me being a big sister for the big, I don't know why she thought that was a good idea. But and I could never get up and make it to the orientation, to the Big Brothers Big Sisters group down in D.C. And so I said, are you talking about volunteer work again? And she goes, no. But that was why, that's why I asked her that, because we had talked about me being a big sister. And she said, no, I think your drinking is a problem, and therapy's not going to help you, and these medications are not going to help you the way you drink. And I said, I have a couple of drinks. She's like, don't tell me that. I don't believe that. I think you drink almost every single day. And I thought, I said, that, no, that's just, I really don't think you understand me at all. And she's like the third or fourth psychiatrist. I'm like, I'm going to have to get another one. So she asked me two questions. I must always tell this when I tell my story, because they stand out in my mind like it was yesterday. She said, do you ever drink all there is to drink, or you close the bar down and it's last call and they're not going to serve you anymore, or you all the 12 packs gone out of the refrigerator, the bottle of wine or the box of wine or whatever, and you still want to go out and get more if you've got time to do it? And I just lied to her through my teeth. I said, no, I don't do that ever. But nobody's ever asked me that before. I don't know if it's in one of our 44 questions, but I did that all the time. I mean, of course, if you're still, you know, if you're still raring to go, and there's a way, it's not midnight yet, and there's a way to get some more, or if you close the bar down and somebody's got a 12-pack, they're going to their house, you know. So I just, you know, lied to her, and I just said no. And I just gave her this really perplexed look, which was probably me thinking, how does she know, you know. And then she said, or how about this? Like, you go out with your friend, you know, you go out with 3 or 4 friends and you order a bottle of wine, like at a nice restaurant. Would you say, of the group of you, would you be like the first person to say, let's get another bottle? And then I thought, who shares a bottle of wine with 3 or 4 other people? I swear. And I said, with complete conviction, absolutely not. I've never done that. I would never do that. And I told that story at one of the women's jails over in Enrico County, and a young lady yelled across the room, and she goes, did she do stuff like that? And I said, I think she did. She and her psychiatrist friends, apparently you drink one bottle of wine. But those questions stood out in my mind, and I didn't make it to AA for 10 more years. But, you know, those little seeds were planted, and I was still having those moments of trying to find my car on Saturday morning and being late for work and thinking that it's about to hit the fan, so I don't want to get fired, so I'm going to leave. Or this is the problem is the D.C., Northern Virginia area, so I'll move down to the Tidewater area, and that will be better. Or the problem is I'm over 30 and still single. I should get married, and then I'll settle down. There was going to be all these different ways to fix it, but I could not wrap my brain around the idea that Alcoholics Anonymous is where I needed to be. So I get married. I've been married about 3 or 4 years, and it's not going well. And I'm at this point, I had been trying for a couple of years to stop and stay stopped, and I couldn't do it. And I was lying and hiding it and making, doing all the things our big book says about I'm going to do just wine. I'm going to do vodka. I'll go back to vodka, but I'll have a glass of ice water in between each vodka and tonic. Then who needs the tonic? And then, I don't like being that person. I don't like remembering that person, but I can't think of really any other way to be. And I don't, my ex-husband, you know, used to say, you know, you just constantly lied about saying you would stop. And I think you know what I mean when I say, in my mind, I wasn't lying. I was telling the truth. I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm unhappy. You're unhappy. Everybody's unhappy. It's not, you know, it's not working anymore. But I just could not see any way to get up on a day-to-day basis and deal with life without some kind of chemicals. So I put the bottle down for almost 18 months. And I picked up a little bottle of Outside Issues that were prescribed for me, Valium. And that's how I managed my alcoholism that year. If things got to be a little too much, then I popped a few pills. And then pretty soon, I did not stay stopped. By then, by the time I hadn't drank for about 18 months, I thought, well, I can probably handle it now. I won't go back to doing all that crazy stuff I was doing before. So then now I've got the pills and the booze. And I could have easily died. I see these celebrities that their heart stops, you know, when they're mixing benzos and booze and different substances. And by then I'm doing any substance. And my husband and I separated, and I moved to St. Louis to take a job at a law firm. I still don't know how that happened, honestly. I had an interview. I had a lot of litigation experience. I convinced them that they should bring me there and I should work for them, and they regretted it. I thought, so Virginia is the problem and the marriage is the problem and I don't have the right psychiatrist or the right meds. And if you'd have told me that, you know, 3 months after moving to St. Louis, I'd find myself in an AA meeting, I would have just been, I wouldn't have believed you. But I was in the emergency room, I think, I want to say at least three times. I fell asleep in a pool house with a citronella candle in an enclosed room. Citronella is an insecticide. It can cause a really bad lung infection. I got one. The year that I promised I would stop drinking, my ex-husband took me out to a restaurant. We ordered this certain champagne. I don't know how to pronounce the word, but it's in a black bottle and it starts with F. And it was a little bitty bottle, and that was Dale's last drink. And so in St. Louis, I decided to go and buy a big bottle of the magic champagne because I didn't drink for 18 months after I had that champagne. But by then, the woman that I'm rooming with doesn't want me around anymore. She's already threatening to evict me. She's a woman who works at my law firm. They don't know what to do with me. I think they're afraid I'm going to sue them if they fire me. And she's has forbidden me from drinking. Do not drink. You cannot bring alcohol into this house. So I went and bought the bottle of magic champagne. And long story short, I'm trying to sneak and take the cork out, and I hit myself in the eye. I ended up in the emergency room again. I had a detached retina. I always thought that, like, I'm so special, I guess, that, it, you know, there's going to be some headline, you know, dumb lawyer kills herself with a candle or a champagne bottle or just, you know, blinds herself because I just would just do these stupid things. So I'm working at this firm. I'm in the emergency room a lot. There were other times, too. There was the benzo withdrawal. That was bad because I just decided that's the problem or the pills. So I just stopped taking those abruptly and had a really bad withdrawal reaction. So 4th of July week, I come home from work, and if I remember it correctly, the 3rd was Monday and the 4th was Tuesday, and then we had to be back at work on Wednesday the 5th. So I'm pretty much a daily drinker by now. That roommate has kicked me out, so I have a little one-room apartment. It was 320 square feet, a sleeping bag, some dishes. I told my ex-husband I want the wedding china. So I had the wedding china, a sleeping bag. And I used to come home from work a lot, and I would go to this market down the street, and they had this pre-mixed margarita stuff. And the plan was always come home, stick it in the freezer, go check my emails or whatever, or take off my lawyer clothes, and then it would get slushy. And I would leave it in there for a while. It never got slushy. Sometimes it didn't even make it to the freezer. The top came off, and I'd pour it over ice. So I was drinking that stuff, lots of it. I had bottles, like, stacked around the kitchen. And I'm just off to the races. And the theory is, I think that if I drink today, Monday, I've got all day tomorrow to kind of recuperate. And I probably shouldn't drink tomorrow because I got to be back at work on Wednesday morning. And I don't remember a whole lot about that night, just like my first drunk. And I woke up the next morning very similar. I'm laying on the floor. I got my hands crossed across my chest. I called a lot of people. That drinking and dialing was something I loved to do. I don't remember what I said to them. And my place was just trashed. The microwave was on the floor on its side, and it was dented in, and you open it up, and somebody had opened a can of clam chowder, somebody, and stuck it in there, and I turned it on because the can was kind of scorched, and there was clam chowder just, like, sprayed all over the place. I just, like, grabbed the whole thing up and threw it in the dumpster down in the basement. But there were dishes everywhere. There were a bunch of vegetables that were chopped up, and there was blood. And when I woke up, my hand was stuck to my shirt, and I tried to, now I kind of peeled it off. I had cut my finger pretty badly. I don't know. I was chopping vegetables, microwaving soup in the can, which is not a good thing. And it's just, you know, and here I am. I mean, this is supposed to fix it. This is like, I don't know what, the fifth time I've moved in 5 years. It's the third job probably in 5 years. My ex-husband's back here in Virginia. And I just want to die. You know, I just wake up and I just go, here we are again, you know. And I remembered those psychiatrists telling me you should go to AA. And I remembered those months that I wasn't drinking, and I will say I was still chemically dependent, but things were a little bit better even when I wasn't drinking. Probably even my antidepressants might have worked on a different level. I don't know, without booze in my system, but I just thought, well, I don't think that's the answer, and it's like going up to that scary security guy at the Penn Station. I don't think this is going to work for me, but I can't think of anything else, and I'm too chicken to kill myself. So I grab the phone and dial 411, and I ask for Alcoholics Anonymous, and they gave me a number right there in St. Louis, and I called it. And to this day, I still love doing phone watch because that's how I got here on a holiday on the 4th of July. So I even like doing phone watch on Christmas and Thanksgiving, and I was the phone watch coordinator over in Tidewater. It's one of my favorite service positions. So this guy answers the phone, and I think, I was telling my sponsors, I think it's kind of like when you're having computer problems and that guy in Pakistan answers the phone. I think it's some, like, big switchboard out there somewhere. I don't think I really understood that it was right down the street at the intergroup office. But I said, I think I want to go to an AA meeting. Can you tell me, like, where I could go to an AA meeting? And he said, yeah, where do you live? And so I gave him my address, and he goes, that's right near a big clubhouse. It's called the Lindell Club, and they have meetings there 7 days a week, sometimes 5 or 6 meetings a day. And you walk out your front door, make a left, make another left. It's just on the back of your block. I didn't know what any of that meant at the time. But he was telling me that there's an AA meeting, like, you know, a half a block from where I'm living. And I thought, I think I really wanted him to say, well, we're closed on the 4th of July. You'll have to come back on Friday or something. So I said, okay, thanks. So, and he said, and it's at noon. And this was like 10:45. So about 12:30, I called him back. But I thought I'm just calling the big switchboard, you know. And I felt like I was unlucky when I recognized the same guy's voice. And because I thought, oh, man, I got the same guy. Because I thought I would just get, you know, like I'd just get the people. And I said, yeah, I called earlier, and I wasn't able to make that noon meeting. Are there any other meetings? And he said, yes, there's one at 1 o'clock. And so I called him back about 2:15, and I said, I swear. And it was the same guy. And I swear I thought that was, like, bizarre. It never occurred to me that there's one guy on the 4th of July manning the telephone at the intergroup office. And I said, yes. And I've tried to pretend like it wasn't me. I said, yes, I was thinking of going to an AA meeting, and I'm just wondering if you could tell me where there's an AA meeting. And he goes, yes. In the Lindell Club, right outside your front door. And he goes, there's one at 4 or 4:30 or something like that. And he said, young lady, you need to just go to the meeting. And I said, okay. And I did. I don't remember. It was literally like right around out the front door, make a left, make another left, and there it was. And that turned out to be a great place to get sober. We don't have much of a clubhouse environment in Richmond or even in Tidewater. They are, but the clubhouse, I think, environment in the Midwest is still, I think, very rich and thriving, but under the Sixth Tradition by itself, separately, not as part of any AA function. I didn't know that at the time, but I would have told you it was an AA clubhouse, but it wasn't. It was a clubhouse that hosted a lot of meetings. And I started going to meetings there. That one first time, and I don't remember much about it, and I just remember going, phew, I made it. And I didn't think that this was where I needed to be, and I didn't think this was going to be any place that was going to help me. And I saw the steps and stuff on the wall, and I saw the God part, and that actually sort of shocked me, because I had been telling clients for years, you need to go to AA. And sometimes I had clients come up and tell me, look, here's my 30-day chip. And I'm like, that's great. Keep going, you know. And one time I decided that I should know what this AA stuff is, because I'm always telling my DUI clients to go there. And this is a little bit before the courts started making everyone go, really. I mean, that was starting to happen a little bit in the early 90s, but not so much as it is now. And I went to a store in Arlington called Happy, Joyous, and Free. And I bought a big book. It was one of the little dark blue ones, the little paperback ones, third edition. And I thought, you know, I'm going to read this, because some of these people that are going to AA are doing really well, and I should kind of understand how it works or whatever. And I opened it up, and I skipped all the beginning part, and I read War Fever ran high in our small New England town, and I put it back on the shelf. But I did buy it, and it sat on my shelf in my office for 10 years. I bought a crystal that day, because they had crystals and New Agey music and all kinds of 12-step stuff and all kinds of little plaques and things with serenity prayer on them. But somehow that book made its way into the boxes that went to St. Louis with me. I think that's bizarre now, because I have no recollection of going, I will take the 10-year-old AA big book with me now that I'm leaving my husband and moving to St. Louis. But it was there on my shelf in my little 300-square-foot apartment. I went to that first meeting. I thought, well, I don't see how this is ever going to help me. And I'm about to get fired and divorced. And how am I going to pay the rent? And I just feel like my problems are a lot bigger than what these people are talking about. But I didn't have any other ideas, and I'd already tried all those. And so that was, I think, a Tuesday or Wednesday that I went to a meeting, and I didn't go back till Friday. I was back at the office, and I'm without alcohol now. for the first time in a really long time for several days. I'm not shaky physically, but inside my brain is just racing a million miles a minute and I can't focus on anything. And I don't want to drink anymore, but I just don't see myself not drinking or doing something. So I said, well, and so I make some excuse and I told my boss I got on the internet and I found another AA meeting right near my office. And it was at 10 o'clock on a Friday morning. And I felt like I don't have any other option. I'm about to jump out of my skin. And that's just a wonderful moment of grace, because that's not how my brain works. Because there had been many days there around 10:30, 11 that I'm about to jump out of my skin. And I'm thinking, it's late enough to have a beer. I've been up. So I would go have early lunch and drink. And I just didn't see that was an option. But I didn't see it as not an option either. I just felt crazy. So I got my car and I drove to this Catholic church around the corner, and there were just these wonderful ladies there. There were a few men, but it was mostly ladies, retired ladies, the kind of people that go to a meeting at 10 o'clock on a Friday morning, you know, not a lot of office kind of people. And I walked, and it was what they used to call a speaker lead meeting, where the speaker just speaks for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then everybody kind of shares. And the lady that was speaking, I just thought, she's not a drinker. I just couldn't wrap my brain around the idea that she, you know, she could have ever been throwing up, or like one time I just couldn't make it to the car, so I crawled, you know, and I had like bloody knees and torn pantyhose, and my ex-husband was just like, I don't know you. And, you know, just this is stupid stuff we do. And she didn't do any of that stuff. But there was about maybe 10 people there. And after she shared, and she had been through a lot, she was recovering from breast cancer, I remember. And she seemed very happy and very serene. And everybody was really nice. And I remember that meeting. I don't remember the first one when I was still pretty hungover. And everybody shared. I had raised my hand. They said, is this anybody's first 30 days? And I raised my hand. And I said, this is my second meeting. They're all welcome, welcome. And then a lot of the people, when they would share, they'd say, oh, I remember my second meeting. And that made me feel like good, but also a little uncomfortable, because I felt like, you know, I could tell they were kind of directing their comments in my direction. But I'm like, yes. It's like it started to dawn on me, like, yeah, if you've been sober 9 years or whatever, like the speaker, you probably had to come to your first and second and third meeting. And, you know, it's starting to click on my mind that this is what I'm supposed to be doing to be here with you guys, is to actually show up and be here with you guys. And so after the meeting was over, a really nice lady came up to me, and I'm trying to get out of there because I did that for a long time. I'd sit near the door, and I'm trying to get out of there. And I thought everybody was in a hurry to leave, but they were literally like chasing me down. So I got, like, you know, kind of out that way and out there outside, and these three little ladies came following after me, and I thought, you know, where are they going? And then when I stopped to look, they stopped too, and so they were following me. And I always think about that now, like, they didn't tell me go get some phone number, you know, here's them, go get some phone numbers or call me. They, like, chased me to the parking lot. And this one lady, Peggy, she said, do you have a sponsor? And I said, no. She said, do you know what that is? I said, no. And she said, then I'm going to be your sponsor. I didn't have to find a sponsor. And she took her checkbook out, and I thought, this is interesting. And she pulled a deposit ticket out and tore her name and address and phone number off the top of it. And she said, where are you going? And I said, I got to go back to work. I just kind of snuck out, and I'm already in trouble there anyway. They hate me. And she said, well, call me at 6 o'clock. And I said, that's very nice of you, really, but I don't want to bother anybody. And I think I'll be okay now. But I had actually shared in the meeting, you know, I said, I've been to one AA meeting, and I'm sitting in my office, and I haven't had a drink since Tuesday, and I want to jump out of my skin, and I don't know how you guys do it. And she said, no, I think you should call me at 6 o'clock. And I said, okay. And I didn't know that's what we do here. You know, we get a sponsor and we call them. And but there I was, and I think I honestly thought she was lonely or something. I didn't know, but I called her at 6 o'clock, and I said, and she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm still at the office because I was kind of away, you know, kind of for a long lunch. So I'm finishing up a few things." And she said, "There's a meeting at the Lindell Club at 7 o'clock, and I think you should go." And I'm like, "Okay." And I won't say that I was always Johnny on the spot doing everything a sponsor said, because I just didn't have it in me. I mean, I did my best, but pretty well early on, if she said go to that meeting at 7 o'clock, I went. And she said call me at 6, I called her. She said my home group meets on Wednesday nights at St. Peter's. You and I can meet for dinner beforehand, and then we'll go to the meeting together. And I was like, okay. I still didn't see how this is all going to work. I still didn't see that. I didn't know for sure that I was an alcoholic. And here's the funny thing. When we first started working steps together, she said, you may be, she was 40 years sober. She was, no, 30 years sober. She'd gotten sober when she was 40, and I was 40, and she was 70. And so she was 30 years sober. And I was telling her, you know, just how I had been at that meeting at the Annunziata Church, and how I just didn't see those ladies as drinkers. They all, you know, they had like, they drove Jaguars and had fancy clothes and pretty purses, and I just couldn't wrap my brain around them being drinkers. And so she'd tell me some drinking stories, and I'm like, ooh, okay. And she said, you may have a hard time thinking that your life is unmanageable because you've been able to get through school and you've had some good jobs, and you know. And she said, I don't. And you know, we would talk about whether or not my marriage was over and whether that was a decision that didn't need to be made that day. And I said to her, honestly, and I still believe this today, I knew my life was unmanageable. I had a harder trouble with the first half of the step because I just didn't see that alcohol could be the problem. And I just had tried so many ways to manage and enjoy my drinking that I just knew there might be one other way out there to do that that I hadn't tried yet. But thankfully, you know, she had me go to enough meetings, and that's when I found my first identification with people at speaker meetings, is when they would talk about trying to manage it. Just if I can do it this way or that way, and how it never worked, or how they would, maybe they could manage it, but then they just hated themselves when they weren't drinking, and they didn't feel normal when they weren't drinking. And I felt, it would just feel this identification, like, yes, I can identify with that. And I've had a couple of younger people that I've worked with, people who are getting sober when they're 18, 19 years old, and they don't know what it's like really to try to manage and enjoy their drinking. I've met with a couple of young ladies that are like, I just either drank to get drunk, and then I, you know, got into so much trouble. And, you know, I was sort of like, gosh, I bet you from the time I talked to that psychiatrist when I was 30 until, and then all through my marriage, I'm just trying to figure out some way that I can continue to drink but not constantly be in trouble with people all the time, and not have my relationships be in the ditch all the time. So I knew my life wasn't manageable. And then and very early on working with her, I knew that if there was a way to manage alcohol, I pretty much had tried it. And if I hadn't tried it, I had come to enough meetings and listened to you all talk about how you had tried it, and that I was never going to be able to manage and enjoy my drinking. And I either had to, like the big book says, decide to go on and drink to the bitter end, or accept a life based on spiritual principles. And I don't think it was that hard at the time. The big book says it can be a difficult. I don't know exactly. I didn't know what it meant. Even today, I want to be, as time goes by, more and more surrendered to this program and to the God of my understanding. And I would have told you at 90 days I was surrendered. Then I was more surrendered at 2 years, and I was more surrendered at 5. In every area of my life where I've had a lot of change, whether it's in my marriage, when my marriage ended, or in a relationship, or with a job, or how I manage my money, I hit bottoms, and then I'm willing to just sort of surrender again. So I don't know what next year's surrender will look like, but I think there are more of them coming because there always have been. I just started working with a new sponsor several months ago, and I said, let's just go back through the book, and you just treat me like I'm a newcomer, and I'll try to have a newcomer mind, and it's been great. It really has. But I don't completely have a newcomer mind because I don't have to rely completely on your experiences of faith and how your higher power takes care of you, because now I have experiences of how my higher power takes care of me. There was 1 year in sobriety that I fell and I broke my ankle. My husband moved out. We lost 3 of our pets, 1 to cancer, 1 was a 19-year-old cat. Our dog went out when the gate was left open, and she got hit by a car. And I think I went around for 6 months just, how are you, Dale? Fine. But just shooting up, showing up. And that's why I'm so grateful for the basics. Have a sponsor. Practice your steps. Have a home group. Have a job. And I don't know why those things work, but they do. They work. It works to just have those things in place, and then they're just taken care of when life arrives. When I first moved to Richmond in 12, I got a really bad review for my first 6 months, and they said they were going to extend my probation, and I was just, like, devastated. I just, like, went home and curled up in a ball, and then I realized it was Monday, and so I'm supposed to be at Safe Crackers, so I went to Safe Crackers. But it all worked out, and I was able to figure out what it was they needed from me. I didn't have a God that was, the reading Billy said was how I established my relationship with God. I used, even though I had gone to church a lot as a kid, and I thought that I knew all the Bible stories, I knew all about Noah and Jonah and the whale, and I didn't know anything about a God that took care of me, that I could talk to every day and sort of give my life over to and let him decide that, and he does decide that what is good for me is what he decides is good for me. But I didn't have that the first year or two in AA. When I talk about my higher power, I would say higher power. And I would say the group of drunks or the good old drunks or good orderly direction. And I even went through a period where I would say Dr. Paul's God, or I'm trying to get to know Dr. Paul's God from the acceptance is the answer story, because I liked his God, but I didn't know his God. And so I would sometimes say, I'm thinking about using Dr. Paul's God. And then now I have Dale's God, and that's just the way it's progressed, and that's what's worked for me. My first sponsor told me to say the serenity prayer when I got up in the morning. I told myself I wasn't really praying, that I was just reciting it to the back of my thumbs, but that was what I was willing to do, and that was enough of a beginning. I did write a 4-step just out of the big book, just like it tells us to. I did a 5th step with a sponsor. I told her everything. By then I had moved back to Virginia. I was trying to repair my marriage, and I was working with a different sponsor, and I was terrified that these things that were happening with the pets dying and the husband threatening to leave, that somehow this wasn't going to have enough depth and weight to keep me sober. It did. And so I didn't hold anything back. When I went to do my 5th step, I told her right off the bat, let me tell you the first 3 things that I don't want to tell you, so I won't hold them back. And so I did do that, and I was just amazed that there was no judgment or no – one of the things I just knew she would want to, like, call and have me checked into the psych ward or something if I told her. She said, I think you'll take better care of yourself now that you're sober and you're doing the deal or something like that. So 6 and 7, I think, are wonderful steps. I mean, we just get a couple of paragraphs out of the big book on them. But I mistakenly thought that if my inventory revealed that I was dishonest or self-seeking or full of pride, and that I needed to then work on being more tolerant or more giving or more humble. That didn't work. Through working with a sponsor and going to lots of meetings and reading literature, I have learned that when I am ready, when I'm entirely ready, like I said, I bottomed out on some things, like how I use my money, how I eat sugar, how I do lots of things. When I'm just sick and tired of being sick and tired of that stuff, and I'm willing to have it removed, things have been removed, and they are. And it's not because I worked on them. Because if I could work on them and fix them, I wouldn't hang out with you guys. I made an 8-step list, and I made some 9-step amends. I was talking, when I first started working with my new sponsor, I said, you know, lately when I go to meetings, the steps are written in past tense, and they feel in past tense in my heart. But now there's been like a little glitch around 8. And I said, I think some things are being revealed to me, some harms that I had caused people, and some indirect amends that I made that I think now probably may need to be direct amends. But I would like you to help me with that. And so we talked about whether or not we were just going to jump in at 8 with some things that have been going on in my heart. But we decided we'd just start with the book, and I love it that she's doing that with me. And so more will be revealed so that I can put 8 and 9 in past tense. And that's just come up in the last, I would say, 6 to 8 months. Oh, I think I'm running out of time, and they're not throwing money at me. So my 10th step, I ask myself a few questions. I don't do that every single day, but I'm working on trying. I'm hoping to do it every day. I do say my prayers every day when I get up in the morning. They're just coming out of my mouth before. I don't want to leave the house without them. I do my best to help other drunks. So and it's always a privilege to do anything for AA. My first sponsor said, say yes to AA. I generally do, and I thank you for asking me to come.